Traditions are salvaged through storytelling, archived in the moments of people's lives, their celebrations, births, deaths, everyday life. Without these stories, traditions can be lost forever. That's why I'm happy to welcome Dr. Marsha Walker McWilliams to the Kessel Podcast today. Dr. Walker McWilliams will discuss her work at the Black Metropolis Research Consortium, or the BMRC, and what they're doing to preserve the Black experience through stories and by making it accessible to everyone. To learn more, go to bmrc.lib.uchicago.edu. Thanks so much for joining me. Welcome to the guest. So I'm so honored to have you here today. Before we go on and talk about BMRC, tell us more about you.
Okay, sure. So, well, thank you, Amelia, for having me on the queso. So I'm Marsha Walker McWilliams, native of the Midwest, born in Ohio, grew up in Michigan, went to school, undergrad and grad in the Midwest area, and then spent about 8 years in Texas. So culture shock, but now back in the Midwest. And I don't know. I love history. I love good food and I love good people.
Yes. Now it sounds like we've had a similar path. I lived in Michigan for a number of years and I'm originally from Texas.
Oh, okay.
So what part of Michigan were you living at?
I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay. Well, my family's still in Detroit and I go back often. I'm in Chicago, so it's not a big drive there, as you probably know.
Yeah.
So what part of Texas did you suffer in for 8 years?
So we were in Corpus Christi for about 2 years. And then the last like 6 years or so was in Houston area.
Okay. Well, I'm from further south. And the reason I said suffer in, because it was so hot and humid growing up. I never got used to it.
Too hot.
Yeah. Not very many good hair days down there with that humidity.
Yeah. You get ready in the morning and you feel like, okay. And as soon as you step out of the door, it's just like you were in a rain shower.
Right. Air conditioning is a must. I don't think there's anyone there without air conditioning these days. So, but we're lucky. We're in Chicago now where we have a variety of temperatures from one day to the next.
Yes.
For the most part, not humid. But I am really excited to talk to you about your work at the Black Metropolis Research Consortium. Now, that's a mouthful, so we'll continue to call it the BMRC.
Yes.
But explain to me what this organization does and who are members of this organization.
Sure. So the Black Metropolis Research Consortium, or BMRC, is basically a consortium of museums, public and private libraries, universities, historical societies, arts organizations, and we actually just got our first government organization as well. And really what bonds all of these members together as part of the consortium is that they all have materials, archives, collections that shed light on Black experiences in Chicago. So essentially you can go to these places. You don't have to be sort of an academic researcher. You can be anyone. And you can go to these spaces and learn more about the history of, you know, people of African descent in Chicago.
Okay. And it's not just limited to Chicago from what I read, because of the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, they do work in the Southern United States. Now, where exactly is that they do that as well?
So the Donnelly Foundation, which is one of our funders, they have been supporting us since 2016. They actually have two geographical areas of focus. So they support the BMRC and a number of other organizations in Chicagoland, but they also support arts organizations and historical organizations in the South Carolina sort of Sea Islands area. So they kind of have the South Carolina, Lowcountry, and then the Chicago. And what's great about the Donnelly Foundation is that when they get us all together, we're able to talk you know, about our different organizations across, you know, our different regions. And so it's awesome to gain perspective and insight from others who are also trying to help people get access to history and collections and information.
Yes. And I know this movement was born out of a situation. It was born out of last summer's, what I understand. Can you tell me a little bit about that reawakening, so to speak?
Yeah. So the BMRC, you know, when everything happened last summer, you know, the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and so many others, we saw a lot of people putting out statements about racial justice and, you know, how awful everything was. And we had to kind of look at ourselves and think about our mission and what it is that we do as an organization, because we're not like, you know, an advocacy organization. We're not a civil rights organization. We're really about education, connection, and history. And so what we decided to do was put together a huge resource list that would help people better understand what was happening in that moment. Why is it that people are protesting? What about protest when it's peaceful and it is driven by mission is important for us to understand? And how do these organizations that exist around us, these libraries, museums, universities, what role have they played in terms of capturing that history? Because, you know, it's a decision for an archivist or a librarian or, you know, even a person who's protesting out on the street. It's a decision to say, I want to capture this moment. There's something important happening that people in history need to be able to see. And so we wanted people to be able to understand what that moment was about and to have resources. You know, why, you know, has protest happened in our country for many generations? Why is it specifically happening on questions of racial justice and what's been happening in 2020? So we put together this resource list and it's crowdsourced. So we ask people, if you see anything that's about documenting protest, if you find, you know, things in your library or collections that are about protest and racial justice, send them to us. You can email them to us and we will add them to this list. So it's been really great that people from all across the country have said, hey, you need to add this to your resource list. And now it's there and available as an educational tool for people.
Okay. Now, I like the phrase, you know, the reawakening, but at the same time, it's heartbreaking to think that it's a reawakening for some people. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it's tough. And I remember it was, you know, end of May, beginning of June. And it just so happened that I had a bunch of different meetings with different groups I volunteer with, I'm a part of, and everybody was just kind of, you know, expressing their sadness, their frustration. And, you know, people were like, well, how do you feel, Marsha? Tell us how you feel. And I'm like, I don't want to talk. I don't want to talk. I don't want to bear anything. I was just tired, right? Like emotionally just tired. And so it's hard when you have people who are just sort of waking up to this, versus people who understand what it's like to walk in these spaces and to walk in racialized bodies every day and to see loved ones who you know who have had difficult situations, you know, with racist folks or, you know, with law enforcement. These things could happen at any time. And so whereas for some people, it's like, oh, this is so horrible. For others, it's sort of walking in this space every day and hoping and praying that it doesn't happen to you or someone you love.
Right, right. And that, I think to me, since, you know, this has really been taking over the media since last year, and I thought, well, this is not new, but people are acting like it's new. And I think that was a big part of like the frustration and the anger that some of us felt. You know, I'm glad that we have resources to go to about the protesting, but at the same time, we also need more education, right? As not just the protesting where we are now, but why is there racial inequality? Why is this still continuing? What's the history behind that? A lot of people weren't understanding. We're saying things like, well, we're all the same and I don't see color. And, you know, no, it's not that cut and dry.
Absolutely. And that's why You know, one of the reasons why I was drawn to working with the BMRC, because every day we are about trying to connect people to history, right? That there are so many documents and personal testimonies that people have left behind mm-hmm. from the past in order to help us understand the moment that we live in. And so when you really know history, you know that these things happen every day and they've been happening for generations. And so we constantly try to point people to the resources. You know, maybe they're interested in looking at, you know, the history of the relationship between African Americans and law enforcement. Mm-hmm. We've had people who have studied that and who have, you know, come to us and worked with our member institutions to find information. But then we also have people who are really interested in, say, like, you know, people of color and literature, people of color and music, and all of these different things. And so we're constantly wanting people to know that history is right there for you to access, right? Yeah. Make of it, you know, what you want, right? Like, you can take a look at the historical record and start to build your own experience.
And what I find fascinating, that the prospect of finding everyday people in these stories and archives, just, yeah. you know, we're used to hearing the iconic names and people think, oh, you know, just a certain people in history when you think about Black history. But what about the everyday people that maybe kept a diary or their photo album, you know, was left mm-hmm. behind, and there are stories there. And maybe mm-hmm. even that connection to, like you said, you have a connection with South Carolina and or North Carolina and Chicago, like, what's the connection there? Like, what was that story like? How did you get here? And there's just so many stories there that we can relate to today and humanize these protests and say yeah. it's more than what we're seeing on the news today. Mm-hmm. Way deeper.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I think that has come out of this moment is that people are starting to understand the importance of the everyday, and that there are so many people out here who have stories, not just about themselves, but their families, their communities, their legacies. And so I do see that as a kind of silver lining, if there is one in this moment, is that we can start to learn more about one another, and we can start to learn more about the communities that we live in, and to sort of care for one another.
Now, what will you do, or your organization, or these organizations that are your members of the BMRC, do to reach that audience that's just so connected through social media? And they're like, well, I'm not going to a library. I'm not. How will you reach that group? Because we know that that's a large group.
Absolutely. So we've started recently doing some social media campaigns where we work with our members to digitize and scan some of the photos that they have, some of the documents that they have, into like an Instagram story. Yeah. So someone can learn, hey, there's this really cool collection about Northwestern, you know, Black undergraduate students who protested in the 1960s because they weren't being treated fairly on that campus. And you can learn more about these individuals, and we show pictures on social media that helps with that. We also advertise a lot of the BMRC's own events, as well as the events of our member institutions that are relevant to African-American history. We publicize that a lot on social media. And we're starting to work more with community-based groups who have large social media presence. And, you know, for some groups, that's the way they actually communicate, right? Is through social media, through email, through text. Which, you know, I'm not going to age myself, but I'm not necessarily of that generation. I'm still a little bit more old school. But there are lots of community-based groups and initiatives that is how they communicate, is through social media. So we're trying to be better in that area for sure.
Well, you know, that's a really great resource for teachers. Now that teachers are online with their students, do you have a lot of teachers reach out to get, you know, curriculum materials, things like that?
We do. We have had some teachers reaching out to us and wanting to work with us. And what I would love for our organization to do is to get some funding to actually have like a little institute mm-hmm. with teachers, so we can work with them and sit with them and really learn more about what they feel will work in the classroom for mm-hmm. their students. Because often, you know, for those of us who are trained historians, or we come from kind of higher ed, we might have these ideas about what works, but I'm a big believer that the people who are doing the work day to day, they're the ones you need to go to and ask what will work for you, because they see it. And so we might have an idea of, oh, you could try this in the classroom, but the teachers are going to know what's actually going to work and resonate with their students. And so being able to kind of collaborate in that way, I think would be awesome.
Yes, yes. And I look forward to seeing more of that. Now, the organizations that can kind of either compete, I don't want to say compete, but who can apply for funding with BMRC, do they have to be in the city of Chicago, or can they be in the surrounding Chicago area?
So there's, I guess there's kind of two parts to this. So the BMRC, we have member institutions who essentially will pay dues every year to be a part of the consortium. And there are a bunch of different benefits that we have for that, which is kind of being tapped into our network, being able to share more of their collections. We have an internship program, a fellowship program, all of those things. But then there are benefits that come through relationships with our funder. So the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, they have just announced this new broadening narrative strategy where they're actually seeking projects from community-based organizations, smaller institutions, even larger institutions, where they want to focus more on those kind of untold stories, right? Those important people, those important initiatives that have happened that haven't kind of gotten their fair due. People don't know about them, or people underestimate the importance of them. Mm-hmm. So the opportunity, this broadening narrative strategy, is ongoing now, and groups can essentially contact the foundation and learn more about how to get funding to support those projects.
Okay, all right. So you can still be a member, and I saw there's quite a few institutions who are members, and you know, like DePaul University, and you know, there's just so many opportunities for just organizations to be part of that. Now, this is not for individual artists, but if an individual artist is part of some organization, they can certainly encourage them to apply for these, you know, this extra funding that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, the Donnelly broadening narrative strategy is great, because often with some foundations in the philanthropy world, a lot of funding and resources will go to the more well-known figures or to the moments in history that people can readily recall. But what's great about the broadening narratives is that it is focused on those kind of untold stories, right? And the important people who are often marginalized or neglected or kept out of history. The focus for this strategy is really on amplifying those stories and those narratives. So if there is an individual artist that maybe wants to talk about the importance of artistic, you know, creativity and production in their particular community, and that's not a part of, you know, the conversations that are going on in the art galleries, there might be a way to spin that into a project that gets funding. And so I think it's really great that this strategy is out there, because it provides a space for people who have been marginalized to be able to take center stage.
Right, right. And so is the BMRC a place like people can go there?
We have a staff office on the University of Chicago campus, and people have visited us. Because of COVID, we have not been there for probably over a year at this point.
Right.
But people are able to visit us. People can make appointments as well. And then we also take in research requests. So maybe you want to learn more about a family member. You want to learn more about your community history. Or if you're working on a project for school and you're like, I don't really know how to find sources for this, where should I start? You can email us. Our email is bmrc@uchicago.edu. And just say, I have a reference request. And we will do what we can to find information for you and help you out. So that's another way that people can get in touch with us.
So is this service for reference materials a free service for anyone seeking information?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone with a question, email us and we will let you know. If we don't have the answer, we will get you in contact with the people who do have the answer.
And I did see on your website, there's kind of like a search engine. You can look up things, keywords, things like that. That's really helpful.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. And right now we actually have a grant where we're going to be updating that and making it, you know, a little jazzier, a little bit easier for everybody to access. And so we're hoping to unveil the new search engine sometime over the summer, early fall.
Speaking of jazzier, I did see you were a part of a few events there on social media. I guess you get called on to be part of certain events, even now during COVID on Zoom mm-hmm. and things like that. That's pretty exciting. I'm glad that the work has continued during this year. And maybe you've even gotten more work done. Who knows?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. We've been really, really busy. I think a part of that is because so many things are done, like over Zoom, and things are happening online, is that in some ways it's almost easier to get people because you're not worried about traveling or, you know, scheduling and all of those kinds of things. It's just, hey, are you free at this time to hop on Zoom and have a conversation? And so that's great, but it has definitely made for a lot more work.
More work. And I a lot of people that I talked to this year are saying how they're going to keep that a part of that even after.
Yeah, I know we will. We actually launched our YouTube channel during COVID. And we've got so many things in the works that we're going to be putting up and making accessible for people so that even if they miss some of our online events, they'll be there. And I would love to see us as well, you know, when we do go back to having more in-person events, still having some events that are online or recording things so that people can still access them.
Adding more to the archives, which is
yes, absolutely.
Exactly, exactly. Now, before I let you go, I wanted to just get your take on, I don't know if you've been staying abreast of the trial that is going on right now. Mm-hmm. The George Floyd trial. I'd rather call it that than something else because I don't want to mention that other name. But any thoughts on that of what you've seen so far, if you have been watching?
You know, I just don't. For me, it's difficult. One, being a person of color in this country. Two, being a historian of this country's history. We just have not always been treated fairly or justly by the criminal system. And so I'm less optimistic than others when it comes to what will happen. And I just keep thinking about, you know, several years ago, watching the Trayvon Martin trial and how awful I felt at the end of that. And thinking about, am I going to feel that awful again? Right. Or even thinking about the fact that we're not even in this space for Breonna Taylor. You know, it's hard. It's really hard to kind of continue to sort of go through these things and to never feel like there's a fair shot in terms of people of color receiving justice. That's tough for me.
Right. And even though the role is kind of reversed. Like there's someone else on trial, still feeling kind of antagonized even in that setting. And think that that's what's kind of escapes a lot of people where there's just figures of authority sometimes where there's just that barrier that automatically goes up.
Absolutely.
I mean, just even in my experience, and I can never say that I know what a person of color or a person with black skin can, I cannot say that I know what that feels like, but even as a minority to the level that I've experienced it or my interaction with law enforcement has been negative, you know, even in my little experience and to think that it's gotten to this point. And you know, even my daughter who's 12 says, you know, why is there a trial? I mean, it's so obvious, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, I know. This is the times that, you know, that we're living in. It's only now because we're able to see it.
Right.
But what was it like when no one was able to see what happened in those courtrooms?
Yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, when there wasn't a video of a man being literally executed, you know, what happens then? It's, you know, it's really tough. And the other thing I tell people is that you have to think about what this does in terms of trauma, especially for people of color, that this can be ongoing kind of traumatic experience. And so I, you know, have friends, family members who are not even watching the trial or keeping in touch with it at all, because it's sort of re-traumatizing them in a way, especially if they watch the video or if they've experienced something, you know, similar to that with friends or family members or others. And so just kind of thinking about that, I always want people to try to kind of put themselves in other shoes and understand, you know, what this moment truly means, especially from the vantage point of people of color.
Right. And, you know, the stories that you are facilitating through your organization, hopefully will get people one step closer to even investigating, finding out, you know, getting a glimpse of life. If there's anything else that can happen, you know, I mean, if there's anything else they can do, is just at least get a glimpse of life.
Yes.
And, and know that, you know, these are people, you know, we're people, and we're, there's real stories, there's weddings, there's births, there's deaths. I mean, it's nothing different on that level, but certainly a huge difference in the way you're treated, just walking into a place, just, you know, just showing up somewhere, and it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. How do we get that across? Well, first by educating.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that the world we live in today was shaped by these people, right? And how they live their lives. Like, we can't ignore them. We can't downplay them. All of these stories, these narratives, these lives contribute to the world that we live in today. And so we have to kind of honor that by, you know, going out and discovering them, sharing what we find, and then finding ways to use that history so we can hopefully have a better, you know, present and a better future.
Right. You know, I'm always reminded, and there's this woman in Detroit, she was my pastor at my church growing up, and she was a Black woman from North Carolina. And she, you know, really went against all odds at her in her time and became a pastor. Wow. She used to clean houses and do laundry. And she had, you know, she had some stories. You know, she was highly educated. She had some stories about just the way she was treated. But then also I would see the side of her where she just made everything so rich and beautiful, and how she would take one lemon and make like this lemon pound cake, you know, and just she would create from just basically nothing, where we would see as a peach, she'd make this cobbler, you know, just like just beautiful traditions.
Yeah.
You know, and just such rich culture that I will always admire. And I hope she knows all the times that I've told her, this was my sister Baxter. Just how much I loved her. She was just an amazing, strong woman. And I'm so sorry.
No. It's when those people come into your life, it changes you, and it like drives you, and it makes you see how important life is and love is and people are. And, you know, people can go through amazing levels of pain and trauma, but still just continue to love and to let people in. And when you, when you get that light, you just want to hold on to it because it's so precious.
She was just an amazing, you know, an amazing woman of God as well. You know, just, and I always thought if I could be half the woman that she was and still come out, you know, on top and be victorious and just be like a whole woman, you know, what a legacy, you know. And I hope one day, you know, her story is told, just, you know, in this way that you are facilitating these stories, because those are the stories that need to be seen and heard. Those are the people, those are the faces that we need to remember.
Absolutely.
So thank you. thank you for being here and just reminding me of this wonderful woman too. It's, you know, it just breaks my heart, and I hope that more people's hearts are touched and are moved to do something, to at least speak up advocate, share.
Yes.
Study.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So thank you. I feel like I know you now. I'm giving you a hug.
Virtual hug.
Thank you so much. You really made my day with your beautiful smile and you're taking your time to talk to me today. I really appreciate you and the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Amelia, for having me and for sharing that beautiful story.
Well, thank you. So I hope to talk to you soon. I'll be in touch. And hopefully once we're up and running, I'll make an appointment to come and see you.
Great. I would love that.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. We'll be talking soon, Marcia.
Okay.
Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.